The river pulled at my torn leg, seducing me into releasing my grip. For a moment, I could not speak. "Ship?" I said at last. "Yes, Emendymion?" "You're here." "Of course, Emendymion, just as you and Emenea instructed me to stay. I am pleased to say that all necessary repairs have been..." "Show yourself," I commanded. It was almost dark. Tendrils of fog curled toward me across the black river. The starship rose, dripping, horizontal, its bow only 20 meters from me in the central current. Blocking the current like a sudden boulder, hovering still half in the water, a black leviathan shedding river water in noisy rivulets. Navigation lights blinked on its bow and on the dripping black shark's fin far behind it in the fog. I laughed, or wept, or perhaps just moaned. "Do you wish to swim to me, sir, or should I come in to you?" My fingers were slipping. "Come in to me," I said, and gripped the branch with both hands. There was a dock in the box on the cryogenic fugue cubby deck, where Aenea used to sleep on the voyage out from Hyperion. The dock in the box was ancient. Hell, the whole ship was ancient. But its auto-repair worked, it was well-stocked, and, according to the garrulous ship on the way out 4 years earlier, the Alistairs had tinkered with it back in the consul's day. It worked. I lay in the ultraviolet warmth as soft appendages probed my skin, salved my bruises, sutured my deeper cuts, administered painkiller via IV drip, and finished diagnosing me. "It is a compound fracture, Emendymion," said the ship. "Would you care to see the X-rays and ultrasound?" "No thanks," I said. "How do we fix it?" "We've already begun," said the ship. "The bone is being set as we speak. The bondplast and ultrasonic grafting will commence while you sleep. Because of the repair to damaged nerves and muscle tissue, the surgeon recommends at least 10 hours sleep while it begins the procedure."
"Soon enough," I said.
"The diagnostic's greatest concern is your fever, Emendymion."
"It's a result of the break, isn't it?"
"Negative," said the ship. "It seems that you have a rather virulent kidney infection. Left untreated, it would have killed you before the ancillary effects of a broken femur."
"Cheery thought," I said.
"How so, sir?"
"Never mind," I said. "You say that you're totally repaired?"
"Totally, Emendymion. Better than before the accident, if you don't mind me bragging a bit. You see, because of the loss of some material, I was afraid that I would have to synthesize carbon-carbon templates from the rather dross rock substrata of this river. But I soon found that by recycling some of the unused components of the compression dampers made superfluous by the ouster modifications, that I could evince a 32% increase in auto-repair efficiency if I..."
"Never mind, Chip," I said. The absence of pain made me almost giddy. "How long did it take you to finish the repairs?"
5 standard months, said the ship. 8 1/2 local months. This world has an odd lunar cycle with 2 highly irregular moons, which I have postulated must be captured asteroids because of the..."
5 months, I said. "And you've just been waiting the other 3 1/2 years?
"Yes," said the ship, "as instructed. I trust that all is well with Abetic and Emenea."
"I trust that too, ship. But we'll find out soon enough. Are you ready to leave this place?"
"All ship systems are functional, Emendymion, awaiting your command."
"Command is given," I said. "Let's go."
The ship piped in the hollow, showing us rising above the river. It was dark out, but the night vision lenses showed the swollen river and the Farcaster Arch only a few 100 meters upstream. I had not seen it in the fog. We rose above the river, above the swirling clouds.
"River's up from the last time I was here," I said.
"Yes," said the ship. The curve of the planet became visible, the sun rising again above fleecy clouds. It floods for a period of some 3 standard months every local orbital cycle, which equals approximately 11 standard months.
"So you know what world this is now?" I said. "You weren't sure when we left you."
"I am quite confident that this planet was not among the 2,867 worlds in the General Catalogue Index," said the ship. "My astronomical observations have shown that it is neither in Pax space nor in the realm of the former World Web or Outback."
"Not in the old World Web or Outback?" I repeated. "Where is it then?" approximately 280 light-years galactic northwest of the outback system known as NNGC 4645 Delta, said the ship. Feeling slightly groggy from the painkiller, I said. A new world, beyond the outback. Why did it have farcasters then? Why was the river part of the Tethys? I do not know, Amendymion. But I should mention that there is a multitude of interesting life forms, which I observed by remotes while resting on the river bottom. Besides the river manta-ish creature, which you and Emania and A. Betic observed downriver, there are more than 300 observed species of avian variety, and at least 2 species of humanoids. 2 species of humanoids? You mean humans? Negative, said the ship. Humanoids. Definitely not old Earth human. One variety is quite small, little more than a meter in height, with bilateral symmetry but quite variant skeletal structure and a definite reddish hue. A memory flitted by of a red rock monolith Ania and I had scouted on the lost hawking mat during our short stay here. Tiny steps carved in the smooth stone. I shook my head to clear it. That's interesting, ship. But let's set our destination. The curve of the world had become pronounced, and stars were gleaming unblinkingly. The ship continued to rise. We passed a potato-shaped moon and moved farther from orbit. The unnamed world became a blinding sphere of sunlit clouds. Do you know the world known as Tien Shan, or the Mountains of Heaven? Tien Shan, repeated the ship. Yes, as far as my memory serves, I have never been there, but I have the coordinates. A small world in the outback, settled by refugees of the Third Chinese Civil War, late in the Hegira. You won't have any trouble getting there? None would be anticipated, said the ship. A simple Hawking drive jump. Although I recommend that you use the autosurgeon as your cryogenic fugue cubby during the jump. I shook my head again. I'll stay awake, ship, at least after the doc heals my leg. I would recommend against that, Amendymion. I frowned. Why? Ania and I stayed awake during the other jumps. Yes, but those were relatively short voyages within the old world web, said the ship. What you now call pack space. This will be a bit more extensive. How extensive? I said. My naked body felt a sudden chill. Our longest jump to Renaissance Vector System had taken 10 days of ship travel time and 5 months of time debt for the pack's fleet waiting for us. How extensive a trip, I said again. 3 standard months, 18 days, 6 hours and some minutes, said the ship. That's not too bad a time debt, I said. I last saw Ania just after her 16th birthday. She would gain a few months on me. Her hair might be longer. We had a greater time debt jumping to Renaissance System. That is not time debt, Amendymion, said the ship. That is ship time. This time the chill along the length of my body was real. My tongue seemed thick. 3 months ship time? How much time debt? For someone waiting on Tien Shan? Said the ship. The jungle world was a speck behind us now as we accelerated toward a translation point. 5 years, 2 months, and 1 day, said the ship. As you are aware, the time debt algorithm is not a linear function of C-plus duration, but includes such factors as... Ah, Jesus, I said, raising my fist to my clammy forehead in the autosurgeon coffin. Ah, damn. Are you in pain, Amendymion? The dolorometer suggests you are not, but your pulse has become erratic. We can increase the level of painkiller. No, I snapped. No, it's all right, I just... 5 years, damn. Did Ania know this? Had she known that our separation would cover years of her life? Perhaps I should have brought the ship through the downriver farcaster. No, Ania had said to fetch the ship and fly it to Tien Shan. The farcaster had brought us to Mare Infinitus last time. Who knows where it would have taken me this time? 5 years, I muttered. Ah, damn. She'll be... Damn, ship. She'll be 21 years old. A grown woman. I'll have missed... I won't see... She won't remember... Are you sure you are not in pain, Amendymion? Your vital signs are turbulent. Ignore that ship. Shall I prepare the autosurgeon for cryogenic fugue? Soon enough, ship. Tell it to put me under while it heals my leg tonight and deals with the fever. I want at least 10 hours sleep. How long until translation point? Only 17 hours. It is well inside this system.
Good, I said. Wake me in 10 hours. Have a full breakfast ready. What I used to have when we celebrated Sunday on our voyage out.
Very good. Anything else?
Yeah. Do you have any record hollows of Anea on our last trip?
I have stored several hours of such records, Emendymion. The time you were swimming in the zero-g bubble on the outer balcony. The discussion you had about religion versus rationality. The flying lessons down the central drop shaft when...
Good, I said. Cue those up. I'll look through them over breakfast.
I will prepare the autosurgeon for 3 months of cryogenic sleep after your 7-hour interlude tomorrow, said the ship.
I took a breath.
All right. The surgeon wishes to commence repairing nerve damage and injecting antibiotics now, Emendymion. Do you wish to sleep?
Yes.
With dreams or without? The medication may be tailored for either neurological state.
No dreams, I said. No dreams now. There'll be time enough for those later.
Very good, Emendymion. Sleep well.
Chapter 15. I am on the Fari marketplace shelf with A. Betic, Jigme Norbu, and George Sarong when I hear the news that Pak's ships and troops have finally come to Chen Shan, the mountains of heaven. We should tell Anea, I say. Around us, above us, and under us, thousands of tons of scaffolding rock and creak with the weight of crowded humanity buying, selling, trading, arguing, and laughing. Very few have heard the news of the Pax's arrival. Very few will understand the implications when they do hear it. The word comes from a monk named Chim Din, who has just returned from the capital of Potala, where he works as a teacher in the Dalai Lama's winter palace. Luckily, Chim Din also works alternate weeks as a bamboo rigger at Swan Kung Su, the Temple Hanging in Air, Anea's project, and he hails us in Fari Marketplace as he is on his way to the temple. Thus, we are among the first people outside the court at Potala to hear of the Pak's arrival.
5 ships, Chim Din had said. Several score of Christian people. About half of them warriors in red and black. About half of the remaining half are missionaries, all in black. They have rented the old red hat sect Gompa near Ron So, the Otter Lake, near the phallus of Shiva. They have sanctified part of the Gompa as a chapel to their triune god. The Dalai Lama will not allow them to use their flying machines or go beyond the south ridge of the Middle Kingdom, but he has allowed them free travel within this region.
We should tell Anea, I say again to A. Betic, leaning close so that I can be heard over the marketplace babble.
We should tell everyone at Joe Kung, says the android. He turns and tells George and Jigme to complete the shopping. Not to forget arranging porters to carry the orders of cable and extra bonsai bamboo for the construction. And then he hoists his massive rucksack, tightens his climbing hardware on his harness, and nods to me. I heft my own heavy pack and lead the way out of the marketplace and down the scaffolding ladders to the cable level. I think the highway will be faster than the walkway, don't you? The blue man nods. I had hesitated at suggesting the highway for the return trip, since it has to be difficult for A. Betic to handle the cables and slideways with just one hand. Upon our reunion, I had been surprised that he had not fashioned a metal hook for himself. His left arm still ends in a smooth stump halfway between his wrist and elbow. But I soon saw how he used a leather band and various leather attachments to make up for his missing digits.
"Yes, Emendymion," he says. "The highway. It is much faster, I agree. Unless you want to use one of the flyers as courier."
I look at him, assuming that he is kidding. The flyers are a breed apart and insane. They launch their paragliders from the high structures, catching ridge lift from the great rock walls, crossing the wide spaces between the ridges and peaks where there are no cables or bridges, watching the birds, looking for thermals as if their lives depended on it, because their lives do depend on it. There are no flat areas on which a flyer can set down if the treacherous winds shift, or if their lift fails, or if their hang gliders develop a problem. A forced landing on a ridge wall almost always means death.
descent to the clouds below always means death. The slightest miscalculation in gauging the winds, the updrafts, the downdrafts, the jet stream. Any mistake means death for a flyer. That is why they live alone, worship in a secret cult, and charge a fortune to do the Dalai Lama's bidding by delivering messages from the capital at Potala, or to fly prayer streamers during a Buddhist celebration, or to carry urgent notes from a trader to his home office to beat competitors, or, so the legend goes, to visit the eastern peak of Taishan, separated for months each local year from the rest of Tian Shan by more than 100 clicks of air and deadly cloud. I don't think we want to entrust this news to a flyer, I say. A. Betic nods. Yes, M. Endymion, but the paragliders can be purchased here at the marketplace, at the Flyers Guild stall. We could buy two and take the shortest route back. They are very expensive, but we could sell some of the pack zygotes. I never know when my android friend is joking. I remember the last time I was under a parasail canopy and have to resist the urge to shiver. Have you ever paraglided on this world, I say? No, M. Endymion. On any world? No, M. Endymion. What would you think our chances would be if we tried, I say? 1 in 10, he says without a second's hesitation. And what are our chances on the cables and slideway this late in the day, I say? 9 in 10 before dark, he says. Less if sunset catches us short of the slideway. Let's take the cables and slideway, I say. We wait in the short queue of market-goers leaving by cable, and then it is our turn to walk onto the step-off platform. The bamboo shelf is about 20 meters beneath the lowest marketplace scaffolding, and it extends about 5 meters farther out over the abyss than does the rest of Fari. Beneath us, there is nothing but air for thousands of meters, and at the bottom of that emptiness, only the ubiquitous sea of clouds that rolls against the ridges of upthrust rock like a white tide spilling against stone pilings. More kilometers beneath those clouds, I know, are poisonous gases and the surging acidic sea that covers all of this world except its mountains. The cablemaster gestures us forward, and Abetic and I step onto the jump platform together. From this nexus, a score or more of cables slant out and down across the abyss, creating a black spider web that disappears at the edge of vision. The nearest cable terminus is more than 1.5 kilometers to the north, on a little rock fang that stands out against the white glory of Chomo Lori, Queen of Snow. But we are going east across the great gap between the ridges. Our terminal point is more than 20 kilometers away, and the cable dropping away in that direction appears to end in mid-air as it blends into the evening glow of the distant rock wall. And our final destination is more than 35 clicks beyond that to the north and east. Walking, it would take us about 6 hours to make the long trip north along Fari Ridge, and then east across the system of bridges and catwalks. Traveling by cable and slideway should take less than half that time, but it is late in the day and the slideway is especially dangerous. I glance at the low sun again and wonder again about the wisdom of this plan.
Ready?
Growls the cable master, a brown little man in a stained patchwork chuba. He is chewing Bessel root and turns to spit over the edge as we step up to the clip-on line.
Ready, A. Bedick and I say in unison.
Keep your distance,
growls the cable master and gestures for me to go first. I shake my traveling risers loose from my full body harness, slide my hands over the crowded gear sling that we call a rack. Find the two-bearing pulley by feel. Clip it onto the riser ring with a carabiner. Run a munter hitch into a second carabiner as a friction brake back up to the pulley brake. Find my best offset D carabiner and use it to clip the pulley flanges together around the cable. And then run my safety line through the first two carabiners while tying a short Prusik sling onto the rope. Finally clipping that onto my chest harness below the risers. All of this takes less than a minute. I raise both hands, grab the D-ring controls to the pulley, and jump up and down, testing both the pulley connection and my clip-ons. Everything holds. The cable master leans over to inspect the double D-ring attachment and the pulley clamp with expert eyes. He runs the pulley up and back a meter, making sure that the near-frictionless bearings are sliding smoothly in their compact housing. Finally, he puts all of his weight on my shoulders and harness, hanging on me like a second rucksack, and then releases me to make sure that the rings and brake lines hold. I am sure that he cares nothing if I fall to my death, but if the pulley was to stick somewhere on the 20 clicks of braided monofilament cable running out there to invisibility, it will be this cable master who will have to clear the mess, hanging from his etriers or belay seat over kilometers of air while waiting commuters seethe. He seems satisfied with the equipment.
"Go," he says and slaps me on the shoulder. I jump into space, shifting my bulging rucksack high on my back as I do so. The harness webbing stretches, the cable sags, the pulley bearings hum ever so slightly, and I begin to slide faster as I release the brake with both thumbs on the D-ring controls. Within seconds, I am hurtling down the cable. I lift my legs and sit back up into the harness seat in the way that has become second nature to me in the past 3 months. Kunlun Ridge, our destination, glows brightly as sunset shadow begins to fill the abyss beneath me, and evening shade moves down the wall of Fari Ridge behind me. I feel a slight change in the cable tension and hear the cable humming as A. Betic begins his descent behind me. Glancing back, I can see him leaving the jump-off platform, his legs straight ahead of him in the approved form, his body bobbing beneath the elastic risers. I can just make out the tether connecting the leather band on his left arm to the pulley brake line. A. Betic waves and I wave back, swiveling in my harness to pay attention to the cable screaming past me as I continue hurtling out over the gorge. Sometimes birds land on the cable to rest. Sometimes there is a sudden ice buildup or braid spurs. Very rarely there is a snagged pulley of someone who has met with an accident or cut away from their harness for reasons known only to themselves. Even more rarely, but enough to fix it in the mind, someone with a grudge or vague psychopathic tendencies will pause on the cable to loop a chalk sling or spring-loaded cam around it, leaving a little surprise for the next person to come flying along the line. The penalty for that crime is death by flinging from the highest platform of Potala or Jo Kung. But this is of little solace to the person who first encounters the chalk or cam. None of these eventualities materialize as I slide across the emptiness under the ultralight cable. The only sound is the light hum from the pulley brake as I moderate my speed in the soft rush of air. We are still in sunlight, and it is late spring on this world. But the air is always chilly above 8,000 meters. Breathing is no problem. Every day since I arrived on Tien Shan, I thank the gods of planetary evolution that even with the slightly lighter gravity here, 0.954 standard, the oxygen is richer at this altitude. Glancing down at the clouds some clicks below my boots, I think of the seething ocean in that wind pressure, stirred by winds of phosgene and thick CO2. There is no real surface land on Tien Shan, merely that thick soup of a planetary ocean, and the countless sharp peaks and ridges rising thousands of meters to the O2 layer and the bright Hyperion-like sunlight. Memory nudges me. I think of another cloudscape world from a few months back. I think of my first day out in the ship before reaching the translation point and while my fever and broken leg were healing, when I said idly to the ship, "I wonder how I got through the Farcaster here. My last memory was of a giant." The ship had answered by running a hollow taken from one of its buoy cameras as it sat at the bottom of the river where we had left it. It was a starlight enhanced image. It was raining and showed the green glowing arch of the Farcaster and tossing treetops. Suddenly, a tentacle longer than the ship came through the Farcaster opening, carrying what looked to be a toy kayak draped about with a mass of riddled parasail fabric. The tentacle made a single, graceful, slow-motion twist, and parasail, kayak, and slumped figure in the cockpit glided, fluttered actually, 100 meters or so to disappear in the thrashing treetops.
"Why didn't you come get me then?"
I asked, not hiding the irritation in my voice. My leg still hurt.
"Why wait all night while I hung there in the rain? I could have died."
"I had no instructions to retrieve you upon your return," said the arrogant, idiot savant ship's voice.
You might have been carrying out some important business that would brook no interruption. If I had not heard from you in several days, I would have sent a crawler drone into the jungle to inquire as to your well-being. I explained my opinion of the ship's logic.
That is a strange designation, said the ship. While I have certain organic elements incorporated into my substructure and decentralized DNA computing components, I am not, in the strictest sense of the term, a biological organism. I have no digestive system, no need for elimination other than the occasional waste gas and passenger effluvium. Therefore, I have no anus in either real or figurative terms. Therefore, I hardly believe I could qualify to be called an...
Shut up, I said. The slide takes less than 15 minutes. I brake cautiously as the great wall of the Kunlun Ridge approaches. For the last few hundred meters, my shadow and Abetic's is thrown ahead of us against the orange-glowing vertical expanse of rock, and we become shadow puppets, two strange stick figures with flailing appendages as we work the riser rings to break our descent and swing our legs to brace for landing. Then the pulley brake sound grows from a low hum to a loud groan as I slow for the final approach to the landing ledge. A 6-meter slab of stone with the back wall lined with padded zygote fleece, made brown and rotten by the weather. I slide and bounce to a stop 3 meters from the wall, find my footing on the rock, and unclip my pulley and safety line with a speed born of practice. Abetic slides to a stop a moment later. Even with one hand, the android is infinitely more graceful than I on the cables. He uses up less than 1 meter of landing runout. We stand there 1 minute, watching the sun balance on the edge of Fari Ridge, the low light painting the ice cone summit rising above the jet stream to the south of it. When we finish adjusting our harnesses and equipment racks to our liking, I say, "It's going to be dark by the time we get into the Middle Kingdom." Abetic nods. "I would prefer to have the slideway behind us before full darkness falls, Emendymion, but I think that this will not be the case." Even the thought of doing the slideway in the dark makes my scrotum tighten. I wonder idly if a male android has any similar physiological reaction. "Let's get moving," I say, setting off down the slab ledge at a trot. We lost several hundred meters of altitude on the cableway, and we will have to make it up now. The ledge soon runs out. There are very few flat places on the peaks of the Mountains of Heaven, and our boots clatter as we jog down a bonsai bamboo scaffold walkway that hangs from the cliff wall and juts out over nothing. There is no railing here. The evening winds are rising, and I seal my therm jacket and zygote fleece tuba as we jog along. The heavy pack bounces on my back. The Jumar point is less than a click north of the landing ledge. We pass no one on the walkway, but far across the cloud-stirred valley, we can see the torches being lit on the walkway between Fari and Joe Kung. The scaffoldway and maze of suspension bridges on that side of the Great Abyss is coming alive with people heading north, some undoubtedly headed for the temple hanging in air to hear Ania's evening public session. I want to get there before them. The Jumar point consists of 4 fixed lines running up the vertical rock wall for almost 700 meters above us. These red lines are for ascension. A few meters away dangle the blue lines for rappelling from the ridge summit. Evening shadow covers us by now and the rising winds are chill. "Side by side," I say to Abetic, gesturing toward one of the middle ropes. The android nods. His blue countenance looks precisely as I had remembered it from our trip out from Hyperion, almost 10 of his years ago. What did I expect? An android to age? We remove our powered ascenders from our web racks and clip onto adjoining lines, shaking the hanging microfiber lines as if that will tell us if they are still anchored properly. The fixed ropes here are checked only occasionally by the cable masters. They could have been torn by someone's Jumar clips, or upbraided by hidden rock spurs, or coated with ice. We will soon know. We each clip a daisy chain and a triers to our powered ascenders.
Abetic unloops 8 meters of climbing line, and we attach this to our harnesses with locking carabiners. Now, if one of the fixed lines fail, the other person can arrest the first climber's fall. Or so goes the theory. The powered ascenders are the most technology owned by most citizens on Tian Shan. Powered by a sealed solar battery, little larger than our hands that fit in the molded grips, the ascenders are elegant pieces of climbing equipment. Abetic checks his attachments and nods. I thumb both of my ascenders to life. The telltales glow green. I jumar the right ascender up a meter, clamp it, step up in the looped Etrir foothold, check that I am clear, slide the left ascender up a bit farther, clamp it tight, swing my left foot up 2 loops, and so on. And so on, for 700 meters. The two of us pausing occasionally to hang from our Etrirs and look out across the valley, where the walkway is ablaze with torches. The sun has now set, and the sky has darkened immediately to violets and purples, the brightest stars already making an appearance. I estimate that we have about 20 minutes of real twilight left. We will be doing the slideway in the dark. I shiver as the wind howls around us. The fixed lines hang over vertical ice for the last 200 meters. We both carry collapsible crampons in our rack bags, but we do not need them as we continue the tiring ritual. Jumar, clamp, step, pull Etrirs free, rest a second. Jumar, clamp, step, pull, rest, Jumar. It takes us almost 40 minutes to do the 700 meters. It is quite dark as we step onto the ice ridge platform. Tian Shan has 5 moons. 4 of them captured asteroids, but in orbits low enough to reflect quite a bit of light. The 5th, almost as large as old Earth's moon, but fractured on its upper right quadrant by a single huge impact crater, whose rays spread like a glowing spider web to every visible edge of the sphere. This large moon, the Oracle, is rising in the northeast as Abetic and I walk slowly north along the narrow ice ridge, clipping onto fixed cables to keep from being blown away by the sub-zero winds that hurtle down from the jet stream now. I have pulled up my thermal hood and dropped my face mask into place, but the freezing wind still burns at my eyes and any bits of exposed flesh. We cannot tarry here long, but the urge to stand and gaze is strong in me, as it always is when I stand at the cableway terminus of Kunlun Ridge and look out over the Middle Kingdom and the world of the Mountains of Heaven. Pausing at the flat, open ice field at the head of the slideway, I pivot in all directions, taking in the view. To the south and west, across the moonlit churn of cloud tops so far below, the Fari Ridge glows in the light of the Oracle. Torches high along the ridge north of Fari clearly mark the walkway, and I can see the lighted suspension bridges much farther north. Beyond Fari Marketplace, there is a glow in the sky, and I fancy that this is the torch-lit brilliance of Potala, Winter Palace for His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and home to the most magnificent stone architecture on the planet. It is just a few clicks north of there, I know, that the Pax has just been granted an enclave at Ran So, in the evening shadow of Shivling, the phallus of Shiva. I smile beneath my therm mask as I imagine the Christian missionaries brooding about this heathen indignity. Beyond Potala, hundreds of clicks to the west, is the ridge realm of Koko Nor, with its countless hanging villages and dangerous bridges. Far south along the great ridge spine called the Lob San Gyatso lies the land of the Yellow Hat sect, ending at the terminal peak of Nanda Devi, where the Hindu goddess of bliss is said to dwell. Southwest of them, so far around the curve of the world that the sunset still burns there, is Musta Alta, with its tens of thousands of Islamic dwellers guarding the tombs of Ali and the other saints of Islam. North of Musta Alta, the ridges run into territory I have not seen, not even from orbit during my approach, harboring the high homes of the wandering Jews along the approaches to Mount Zion and Mount Moriah, where the twin cities of Abraham and Isaac boast the finest libraries on Tian Shan. North and west of them rise Mount Sumeru, the center of the universe, and Harney Peak, also the center of the universe, oddly enough, both some 600 clicks southeast of the four San Francisco peaks, where the Hopi Eskimo culture there ekes out a living on the cold ridges and fern clefts, also certain that their peaks bound the center of the universe. As I turn and look due north, I can see the greatest mountain in our hemisphere, and the northern boundary of our world, since the ridge disappears beneath phosgene clouds a few clicks north of there. Chomo Lori, Queen of Snow. Incredibly, the sunset still lights Chomo Lori's frozen summit, even as the oracle bathes its eastern ridges with a softer light. From Chomo Lori, the Kunlun and Fari ridges both run south, the gap between them widening to unbridgeable distances south of the cableway we have just crossed. I turn my back to the north wind and look to the south and east, tracing the looping Kunlun ridgeline, imagining that I can see the torches some 200 clicks south where the city of Si Huang Mu, Queen Mother of the West, west being south and west of the Middle Kingdom, shelters some 35,000 people in the safety of its notches and fissures. South of Si Huang Mu, with only its high summit visible above the jet stream, rises the great peak of Mount Koya, where, according to the faithful who live in ice tunnel cities on its lower reaches, Kobo Daishi, the founder of Shingon Buddhism, lies interred in his airless ice tomb, waiting for conditions to be right before emerging from his meditative trance. East of Mount Koya, out of sight over that curve of the world, are Mount Kalei, home to Kubera, the Hindu god of wealth, as well as to Shiva, who evidently does not mind being separated from his phallus by more than 1,000 kilometers of cloud space. Parvati, Shiva's wife, is also reputed to live on Mount Kalei, although no one has heard her opinion of the separation. Abedic had traveled to Mount Kalei during his first full year on the planet, and he told me that the peak was beautiful, one of the tallest peaks on the planet, more than 19,000 meters above sea level, and he described it as looking like a marble sculpture rising from a pedestal of striated rock. The android also said that on the summit of Mount Kalei, high on the ice fields where the wind is too thin to blow or breathe, sits a carboned alloy temple to the Buddhist deity of the mountain, Demchog, the one of supreme bliss, a giant at least 10 meters tall, as blue as the sky, draped with garlands of skulls and happily embracing his female consort as he dances. Abedic said that the blue-skinned deity looks a bit like him. The palace itself is in the precise center of the rounded summit, which lies in the center of a mandala made up of lesser snow peaks, all of it embracing the sacred circle, the physical mandala of the divine space of Demchog, where those who meditate will discover the wisdom to set them free from the cycle of suffering. In sight of the Mount Kalei Demchog mandala, said Abedic, and so far to the south that the peak is buried beneath kilometer-deep glaciers of gleaming ice, rises Helgafell, the Mead Hall of the Dead, where a few hundred Hegira-transplanted Icelanders have reverted to Viking ways. I look to the southwest. If I could someday travel the arc of the Antarctic Circle there, I know, I would come across such peaks as Gunung Agung, the navel of the world, one of dozens on Tian Shan, where the Eka Dasa Rudra Festival is now 27 years into its 600-year cycle, and where the Balinese women are said to dance with unsurpassed beauty and grace. Northwest, more than 1,000 clicks along the high ridge from Gunung Agung, is Kilimachago, where the denizens of the lower terraces disinter their dead from the loamy fissures after a decent interval and carry the bones high above breathable atmosphere, climbing in hand-sewn skin suits and pressure masks to rebury their relatives in rock-hard ice near the 18,000-meter level, with the skull staring through ice toward the summit in eternal hopefulness. Beyond Kilimachago, the only peak I know by name is Krogue Patrick, which reputedly has no snakes, but as far as I know, there are no snakes anywhere else on the mountains of heaven. I turn back to the northeast. The cold and wind buffet me head-on, urging me to hurry, but I take this final minute to look out toward our destination. Abetic also appears to be in no rush, although it might be anxiety about the coming slideway that causes him to pause here a moment with me. To the north and east here, beyond the sheer wall of the Kunlun Ridge, lies the Middle Kingdom, with its five peaks glowing in the lantern light of the oracle. To the north of us, the walkway and a dozen suspension bridges cross the space to the town of Zhou Kung, and the central peak of Sung Shan, the lofty, although this is by far the lowest of the five summits of the Middle Kingdom. Ahead of us, connected from the southwest only by a sheer ice ridge branded by the looping route of the slideway, rises Hua Shan, Flower Mountain, the westernmost summit in the Middle Kingdom and arguably the most beautiful of the five peaks. From Hua Shan, the final clicks of cableway connect the Flower Mountain to the spur ridges north of Zhou Kung, where Ania works on Swan Kung Su, the temple hanging in air, set into a sheer cliff face looking north across the abyss to Heng Shan, the sacred mountain of the north. There is a second Heng Shan some 200 clicks to the south, marking the Middle Kingdom's boundary there. But it is an unimpressive mound compared to the sheer walls, great ridges, and sweeping profile of its northern counterpart. Looking north through the raging winds and sheets of spindrift, I remember being in the consul's ship and floating between the noble Heng Shan and the temple on that first hour on the planet. Glancing to the east and north again, beyond Hua Shan and the short central peak of Sung Shan, I can easily see the incredible summit of Tai Shan, silhouetted against the rising oracle more than 300 clicks away. This is the great peak of the Middle Kingdom, 18,200 meters tall, with its town of Tai'an, the city of peace, hunkered down at the 9,000-meter level, and its legendary 27,000-step staircase rising from Tai'an through the snowfields and rock walls, all the way to the mythical temple of the Jade Emperor on the summit. Beyond our sacred mountain of the north, I know, rise the four mountains of pilgrimage for the Buddhist faithful. Omei Shan to the west, Chu Hua Shan, Nine Flower Mountain, to the south, Wu Tai Shan, the Five Terrace Mountain with its welcoming purple palace to the north, and lowly but subtly beautiful Pu To Shan in the far east. I take a few final seconds on this wind-battered ice ridge, glancing toward Zhou Kung, hoping to see the torchlights lining the fissure pass over to Swan Kung Su, but high clouds or sheets of spindrift haze the view, so that only an oracle-lighted blur is to be seen. Turning to Abetic, I point toward the slideway and give the thumbs-up gesture. The wind is blowing too hard now to carry words. Abetic nods and reaches back to unfurl the folding sled foil from an outside pocket on his pack. I realize that my heart is pounding from more than exertion as I find my own sled foil and carry it to the slideway launch platform. The slideway is fast. That has always been its appeal. And that is its greatest danger. There are still places in the packs, I am sure, where the ancient custom of tobogganing still exists. In that sport, one sits on a flat-bottomed sled and hurtles down a prepared ice course. This pretty much describes the slideway. Except that instead of a flat-bottomed sled, Abetic and I each have a sled foil, which is less than a meter long and curves up around us like a spoon. The sled foil is more foil than sled, as limp as so much aluminum wrap, until we each divert a bit of power from our ascenders, sending the piezoelectric message to the stiffeners in the foil structure until our little sled seemed to inflate, taking form in a few seconds. Ania once told me that there used to be fixed carbon-carbon lines running the length of the slideway, and the sledders had clipped onto them much as we would a cableway or a rappel line, using a special low-friction clip ring similar to the cable pulley to keep from losing speed. That way, one could brake using the cable or, if the sled were to fly off into space, use the clip line as a self-arrest harness. There would be bruises and broken bones with such a safety line, but at least the body would not fly out into space with the sled. But the cables had not worked, Anea said. They took too much maintenance to keep clear and functioning. Sudden ice storms would freeze them to the side of the slideway, and someone traveling 150 clicks an hour would suddenly have their clip ring encounter immovable ice. It is hard enough these days keeping the cableway clear. The fixed lines of the slideway had been unmanageable. So the slideways were abandoned. At least until teenagers looking for a thrill and adults in a serious hurry found that 9 times out of 10, one could keep the sled foils in the groove just by glissading. That is, by using one or more ice axes in the self-arrest position and keeping the speed low enough to stay in the trough. Low enough, meaning beneath 150 clicks per hour. 9 times out of 10, it would work. If one was very skillful. And if the conditions were perfect. And if it was daylight. A. Bettick and I had taken the slideway 3 other times, once returning from Fari with some medicine needed to save a young girl's life, and twice just to learn the turns and straightaways. The voyage had been exhilarating and terrifying those times, but we had made it safely. But each time had been in daylight, with no wind, and with other glissaders ahead of us showing the way. Now it is dark. The long run gleams wickedly in the moonlight ahead of us. The surface looks iced and rough as stone. I have no idea if anyone has made the run this day, or this week. If anyone has checked for fissures, ice heaves, fractures, cave-ins, crevasses, ice spikes, or other obstacles. I do not know how long the ancient toboggan runs had been, but this slideway is more than 20 clicks long, running along the side of the sheer Abruzzi Spur connecting Kunlun Ridge to the slopes of Hua Shan, flattening out on the gradual ice fields on the west side of the Flower Mountain, kilometers south of the safer and slower walkway looping down from the north. From Hua Shan it is only 9 clicks and 3 easy cable runs to the scaffolding of Zhou Kung, and then a brisk walk through the Fisher Pass and down onto the sheer face walkways to Swan Kung Su. A. Bettick and I are sitting side by side like children on sleds, waiting for a push from Mommy or Daddy. I lean over, grab my friend's shoulder, and pull him closer so that I can shout through the thermal material of his hood and face mask. The wind is stinging me with ice now.
"All right if I lead?" I yell.
A. Bettick turns his face so that our cloth-covered cheeks are touching.
"Emendymion, I feel that I should lead. I have done this slideway 2 more times than you, sir."
"In the dark?" I shout. A. Bettick shakes his hooded head.
"Few try it in the dark these days, M. Endymion, but I have a very good memory of every curve and straight. I believe I can be helpful in showing you the proper braking points."
I hesitate only a second.
"All right," I say.
I squeeze his hand through our gloves. With night vision goggles, this would be as easy as a daylight slideway glissade, which does not qualify as easy in my book. But I had lost the goggles that I had taken on my Farcaster Odyssey, and although the ship carried replacement pairs, I had left them in the ship. "Bring 2 skin suits and rebreathers," Rachel had relayed from Anea. She might have mentioned night vision goggles. Today's jaunt was supposed to have been an easy hike to Fari Marketplace, a night spent in the hostelry there, and then a pack trip back with George Sarong, Jigme Norbu, and a long line of porters hauling the heavy material for the building site. Perhaps, I think, I'm overreacting to the news of the pack's landing. Too late now. Even if we turn around, the rappel down the fixed lines on Kunlun Ridge would be as much trouble as this glissade. Or so I lie to myself. I watch as A. Bettick rigs his short, 38-centimeter, ice-climbing hammer in the loop of the wristband on his left arm, then readies his regular 75-centimeter ice axe. Sitting cross-legged on my sled, I slip my own ice hammer into my left hand and trail my longer ice axe in my right like a tiller. I give the android the thumbs-up signal again and watch as he pushes off in the moonlight, spinning once, then steadying the sled expertly with his short ice hammer, chips flying, and then hurtling over the brink and out of sight for a minute. I wait until there is an interval of 10 meters or so, far enough to avoid the ice spray of his passing, close enough to see him in the orange light of the oracle. And then I push over myself. 20 kilometers. At an average speed of 120 clicks per hour, we should cover the distance in 10 minutes. 10 freezing, adrenaline pumping, gorge rising, terror beating against the ribs, react in a microsecond or die, minutes. A. Bettick is brilliant. He sets up each turn perfectly, coming in low for the high-banked curves so that his apogee, and mine a few seconds later, will be teetering right at the lip of the icy bank, careering out of the banked turn at just the right speed for the next descending straight, then banging and skipping down the long icy ramp so fast that vision blurs. The pounding comes up through my tailbone and spine so that vision is doubled, trebled, and my head pounds with the pain of it, then blurs again with the spray of ice chips flying, creating halos in the moonlight, bright as the unblinking stars spill and reel above us. The brilliant stars competing even with the oracle's glow and the asteroid moon's quick tumbling light. And then we are breaking low and bouncing hard and riding high again, arresting into a sharp left that takes my breath away, then skidding into a sharper right, then pounding and flying down a straight so steep that the sled and I seem to be screaming into free fall. For a minute, I am looking straight down at the moonlit phosgene clouds, green as mustard gas in the lying moonlight. Then we are both racketing around a series of spirals, DNA helix switchbacks, our sleds teetering on the edge of each bank, so that twice my ice axe blade bites into nothing but freezing air. But both times we drop back down and emerge, not exiting the turn so much as being spit out of them, two rifle bullets fired just above the ice. And then we bank high again, come out accelerating onto a straight, and shoot across 8 kilometers of sheer ice wall on the Abruzzi Spur, the right banked wall of the slideway now serving as the floor of our passage, my ice axe spinning chips into vertical space as our speed increases, then increases more, then becomes something more than speed, as the cold, thin air slices through my mask and thermal garments and gloves and heated boots to freeze flesh and to tear at muscle. I feel the frozen skin of my cheeks stretching under my thermal mask as I grin idiotically, a rictal grimace of terror and the sheer joy of mindless speed, my arms and hands adjusting constantly, automatically, instantly to changes in the ice axe tiller and the ice hammer brake. Suddenly, Abetic swerves to the left, chips flying as he bites deep with the curved blades of both long and short axes. It makes no sense. Such a move will send him, both of us, bouncing off the inner wall, the vertical ice wall, and then screaming out into black air. But I trust him, making the decision in less than a second, and slam the blade of my large axe down, pounding hard with my ice hammer, feeling my heart in my throat as I skid sideways and threaten to slide right instead of left, on the verge of spinning and spiraling off the narrow ice ledge at 140 kilometers per hour. But I correct and stabilize and flash past a hole in the ice floor where we would have been sliding except for this wild detour, hurtling onto a broken-away ledge 6 or 8 meters wide, a trap door to death. And then Abetic rackets down off the inner wall, catches his slide with a flash of ice axe blades in the moonlight, and then continues hurtling down the Abruzzi Spur toward the final series of turns onto the Hua Shan ice slopes. And I follow. On the Flower Mountain, we are both too frozen and shaken to rise from our sleds for several cold minutes. Then, together, we get to our feet, ground the piezoelectric charges in our sleds, collapse them, and fold them away in our packs. We walk the ice path around the shoulder of Hua Shan in silence, I in awe of Abetic's reactions and courage. He in silence I cannot interpret, but fervently hope is not anger at my hasty decision to return via this route. The final 3 cableway flights are anticlimax, noted only for the beauty of the moonlight on the peaks and ridges around us, and for the difficulty I have in closing my frozen fingers on the D-ring brakes. Joe Kung is ablaze with torches after the moonlit emptiness of the upper slopes, but we avoid the main scaffolds and take the ladders to the Fisher Pass. Then we are surrounded by the shadowed darkness of the north face, broken by sputtering torches along the high walkway to Swan Kung Su. we jog the last kilometer. We arrive just as Ania is beginning her early evening discussion session. There are about 100 people crowded into the little platform pagoda. She looks across the heads of the waiting people, sees my face, asks Rachel to begin the discussion, and comes immediately to where Abedic and I stand in the windy doorway. Chapter 16. I admit that I was confused and a bit depressed when I first arrived on the mountains of heaven. I slept in cryogenic fugue for 3 months and 2 weeks. I had thought that cryogenic fugue was dreamless, but I was wrong. I had nightmares for most of the way and awoke disoriented and apprehensive. The translation point in our outbound system had been only 17 hours away, but in the Tien Shan system we had to translate from C+ out beyond the last icy planet and decelerate in-system for 3 full days. I jogged the various decks, up and down the spiral staircase, and even out onto the little balcony I'd had the ship extrude. I told myself that I was trying to get my leg back into shape. It still hurt despite the ship's pronouncement that the dock in the box had healed it and that there should be no pain. But in truth, I knew I was trying to work off nervous energy. I'm not sure that I remembered ever being so anxious before. The ship wanted to tell me all about this star system in excruciating detail. G-type yellow star, blah, blah, blah. Well, I could see that. 11 worlds, 3 gas giants, 2 asteroid belts, a high percentage of comets in the inner system, blah, blah, blah. I was interested only in Tien Shan, and I sat in the carpeted hollow pit and watched it grow. The world was amazingly bright. Blindingly bright, a brilliant pearl set against the black of space. "What you are seeing is the lower permanent cloud layer," droned the ship. "The albedo is impressive. There are higher clouds. See those storm swirls in the lower right of the illuminated hemisphere? Those high cirrus-causing shadows near the north polar cap? Those are the clouds that would bring weather to the human inhabitants." "Where are the mountains?" I asked. "There," said the ship, circling a gray shadow in the northern hemisphere. "According to my old charts, this is a great peak in the northern reaches of the eastern hemisphere, Chomo Lori, Queen of Snow. And you see these striations running south from it? See how they stay close together until they pass the equator and then spread farther and farther apart until they disappear into the south polar cloud masses? These are the 2 great spine ridges, Fari Ridge and Kunlun Ridge. They were the first inhabited rock lines on the planet, and are excellent examples of the equivalent early crustaceous Dacotan violent upthrust resulting in blah, blah, blah. And all I could think of was Ania. And Ania. And Ania. It was strange entering a system with no Pax Fleet ships to challenge us. No orbital defenses, no lunar bases. Not even a base on the giant bullseye of a moon that looked as if someone had fired a single bullet into a smooth orange sphere. No register of Hawking drive wakes or neutrino emissions or gravitational lenses or cleared swaths of busser jet drones. No sign of any higher technologies. The ship said that there was a trickle of microwave broadcasting emanating from certain areas of the planet. But when I had them piped in, they turned out to be pre-Hegira Chinese. This was a shock. I had never been on a world where the majority of humans spoke anything but a version of Web English. The ship entered geosynchronous orbit above the eastern hemisphere. "Your directions were to find the peak called Hengshan, which should be approximately 650 kilometers southeast of Chomo Lori. There!" The telescopic view in the hollow pit zoomed in on a beautiful fang of snow and ice, leaping through at least 3 layers of cloud, until the summit gleamed clear and bright above most of the atmosphere. "Jesus," I whispered. "And where is Swan Kung Su, the temple hanging in air?" "It should be there," said the ship triumphantly. We were looking straight down at a vertical ridge of ice, snow, and gray rock. Clouds broiled at the base of this incredible slab. Even looking at this through the hollow viewer made me grab couch cushions and reel in vertigo. "Where?" I said. There were no structures in sight. "That dark triangle. said the ship, circling what I thought was a shadow on one gray slab of rock. And this line, here.
What's the magnification? I asked.
The triangle is approximately 1.2 meters along the longest edge, came the voice I'd grown to know so well from my comm log.
Pretty small building for people to live in, I pointed out.
No, no, said the ship. This is just a bit of a human-made structure protruding from under what must be a rock overhang. I would surmise that the entire so-called temple hanging in air is under this overhang. The rock is more than vertical at this point. It pitches back some 60 or 80 meters.
Can you get us a side view so that I can see the temple?
I could, said the ship. It would require repositioning us in a more northerly orbit so that I can use the telescope to look south over the peak of Hangshan and go to infrared to look through the cloud mass at 8,000 meters, which is passing between the peak and the ridge spur on which the temple is built. I would also have to...
Skip it, I said. Just tight beam that temple area, hell, the whole ridge, and see if Anea is waiting for us.
Which frequency? Said the ship.
Anea had not mentioned any frequency. She had just said something about not being able to land in a true sense, but to come down to Swan Kung Su anyway. Looking at this vertical and worse than vertical wall of snow and ice, I began to understand what she meant.
Broadcast on whatever common frequency we would have used if you were calling a comm log extension, I said.
If there's no answer, dial through all the frequencies you have. You might try the frequencies that you picked up earlier.
They were coming from the southernmost quadrant of the Western Hemisphere, said the ship in a patient voice. I picked up no microwave emanations from this hemisphere.
Just do it, please, I said. We hung there for half an hour, sweeping the ridge with tight beam, then broadcasting general radio signals toward all the peaks in the area, then flooding the hemisphere with short queries. There was no response.
Can there actually be an inhabited world where no one uses radio? I said. Of course, said the ship. On Ixion, it is against local law and custom to use microwave communication of any sort. On New Earth, there was a group which...
Okay, okay, I said. For the thousandth time, I wondered if there were a way to reprogram this autonomous intelligence so that it wasn't such a pain in the ass.
Take us down, I said. To which location? Said the ship. There are extensive inhabited areas on the high peak to the east. Taishan, it is called on my map, and another city south on the Kunlun Ridge. It is called Si Wang Mu, I believe, and other habitations along the Fari Ridge and west of there in an area marked as Koko Nor. Also,
take us down to the temple hanging in air, I said. Luckily, the planet's magnetic field was completely adequate for the ship's EM repulsors, so we floated down through the sky rather than having to descend on a tail of fusion flame. I went out to the balcony to watch, although the hollow pit or screens in the top bedroom would have been more practical. It seemed to take hours. But actually, within minutes, we were floating gently at 8,000-some meters, drifting between the fantastic peak to the north, Hangshan, and the ridge holding Swan Kung Su. I had seen the Terminator rushing from the east as we descended, and according to the ship, it was late afternoon here now. I carried a pair of binoculars out to the balcony and stared. I could see the temple clearly. I could see it, but I could not quite believe it. What had seemed a mere play of light and shadow beneath the huge, striated, overhanging slabs of gray granite was a series of structures extending east and west.